I'm Dana Carvey.
I'm David Spade.
Fly on the Wall's back for another season now on audio and video every Monday and Thursday.
So many incredible guests will be joining us.
Follow and listen to Fly on the Wall everywhere you get your podcasts.
Too good to be true.
This is a true crime and real-time update from the On Deadline podcast. I'm your host, Lauren Berry. Today, we're taking a look at teens who kill, in particular, teen mass shooters. In 1999, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold shocked the nation when they killed their fellow Columbine High School students. Since that time, more mass shootings have made headlines, and many of them have been carried out by young perpetrators. These criminals have faced increased public attention. According to the Violence Prevention Project at Hamline University, shooters between the ages of 11 and 19 have been responsible for 19 mass shootings in the U.S. since 1966, killing 162 people and injuring 145. For this episode, we'll be addressing four of these shooters: Peyton Gendron, Salvador Ramos, Colt Gray, and Ethan Crumbly, as well as the devastation that they've left behind. We'll start in Buffalo, New York. That's where Gendron opened fire at a Tops convenience store back in May 2022. He killed 10 black people during the massacre. Here's a report from WBEN in Buffalo shortly after the shooting, with attorney Paul Cambria.
It seems very clear from the bits and pieces that we have so far that this individual was specifically targeting a specific race and a specific part of the city. So the racially motivated quotient, you would think, would be fairly easy to connect the dots on.
Yeah, it seems that way. Apparently there is the manifesto. Supposedly he may have had a racist statement written on his gun. There are a number of things that would give the federal authorities the basis to lodge a racially motivated crime.
Gendron was 18 at the time, and a 2023 study found that this manifesto was deeply tied to hate content he consumed online. As of today, he's already been sentenced to life in prison, and he's now the subject of a death penalty trial that moved forward this week with the submission of witnesses and exhibits. Attorney John Elmore joined WBEN to discuss this trial.
He represents families of victims of the Tops mass shooting. Today is an important day in the federal death penalty trial of the Tops shooter. John, witness lists are due today. What exactly does that mean?
Well, it's called evidence disclosure. Not only do both sides, the prosecution and the defense, have to provide a list of witnesses to each other, but they have to provide a list of experts and exhibits. It is not a public disclosure. It's a private disclosure that will be done under seal. But the purpose of it is for both sides to have adequate notice of what the evidence is going to be to prepare for trial. And also, at some point in time, there may be challenges on each side about the admissibility of any proposed experts or exhibits. There's something that's called a motion in limine, where each side could challenge the admissibility of whatever proposed experts that they have, whatever proposed exhibits they have, and possibly certain witnesses.
Now, when it comes to this witness list, I think a lot of people might be thinking, oh, well, what does it really matter? We know what happened. We know he's guilty. Why do we need all these witnesses? But in a death penalty case, the emotion shown by a witness, I feel like, could really mean a lot in the end.
Well, so the death penalty, in a death penalty case, it's different than other trials. There's a guilt phase, and then there's a sentencing phase. It's a case where the jury actually determines the sentence of a person who is convicted of a death-eligible crime. And so at the penalty stage, because I think it's almost certain that he'll be found guilty because he's already pled guilty without the possibility of parole in state court, the defense is going to try to put in mitigating evidence. What led up to the murder? What circumstances, would death not be the appropriate sentence? Could be his age, could be mental condition, his upbringing, anything that they would put in front of a jury that would say, yes, he did this, but this is what led up to it. I wouldn't use the word excuse, but a mitigating circumstance that would outweigh the aggravating factors. And the prosecution is going to say that there are certain legal standards called aggravating factors that the judge will explain, but the number of victims, was this pre-planned and premeditated? Were there victims that were extremely vulnerable and those type of things? And then a jury is 20 jurors are going to have to agree. I mean, I'm sorry, 12 jurors are going to have to agree that death would be the appropriate sentence. Or if one of those 12 jurors believes that death is not the appropriate sentence, then the shooter would spend the rest of his natural life in jail. And it is rare in the United States that somebody gets executed for a federal death penalty crime. And there's a huge decades where no one was executed, and then in the last days of the first Trump administration, 13 people were executed. But today, there are only 3 people on federal death penalty roll and on death row, and that's Robert Bowers out of Pittsburgh for the Tree of Life shooting, Dylan Roof, who did the mass shooting at a church in Charleston, and the guy that did the Boston Marathon bombing in 2015. And even though all 3 were sentenced to death, they have not been executed yet.
What is the timeline right now for this trial? And will it definitely be in Buffalo or not necessarily?
The trial is scheduled for August next summer. There has been a motion for a change of venue. The defense has argued or alleged that they're not going to be able to find a fair and impartial jury here in Western New York because of the pre-trial publicity and the number of people that were involved. But the judge reserved decision on that. And during the jury selection process, all of these jurors are going to receive questionnaires, and then they're going to be questioned individually by the judge. And if it appears at that point in time that you cannot get a fair and impartial jury, then it would be transferred to another part of the state, perhaps downstate in New York City. But that determination will not be done anytime soon. It will be done during the jury selection process.
But given everything you're saying here, all these different steps, this is going to be a long trial.
It's the whole jury selection process is going to at least take a month, and the trial is going to take a long time. And the sad part of it is the family and the community that has experienced a collective trauma is going to have to experience that all over again. It's a sad day. It's probably one of the worst tragedies that I've ever seen in my lifetime, and certainly in this area. And the families are look, and the community that's experienced a collective trauma want finality. It's important that people are patient, because if the court makes the wrong decision, if the defense lawyers don't file the proper motions and make the proper arguments, and the judge makes the wrong decision, then the case could be tried over again, and that's one thing that we don't want. So I think it's just important that we're patient and realize that, you know, if this that this case should only be tried once, so that we don't have to relive it again, and kind of hold our nose to every motion that gets filed and every delay and everything else, and just realize that, hey, give them a fair trial and let the jury decide what the appropriate sentence is.
Do you have a dark curiosity? Follow and listen to Heart Starts Pounding on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
While Gendron's trial rolls on, the Buffalo community continues to grieve the lives he took that tragic Saturday afternoon.
Akua Menzaidu was with the Clementine Gold Group. We're talking about the three-year anniversary of the Tops shooting on 514 coming up in just a couple of days. And there are a group of people hoping to remember that going forward with a day of service. Akua, thanks for being on with us this morning. A day of service and remembrance. Where did this idea come from?
Yeah, so, you know, as we thought about the 3 years, we really wanted to take back this specific day. When we've spoken to other members in our community, we thought about how folks forget incidents like this over time. And so we wanted to think about a way that we could really honor these folks, you know, and continue to honor them through things like service, right? A lot of these folks already were doing service-oriented things in their own community. I knew Kat Massey personally, and she had a pocket park that she would have folks come and do picnics and, you know, just be around greenery. And so we wanted to clean up that park, plant new flowers in her memory and honor. And we wanted to do that throughout the community in general.
You know, Akua, how many service opportunities are there for people to get involved in?
Yeah, we have about 8 to 10 service opportunities at this point, you know, spanning from volunteering at these different pocket parks in our community to donating food to pantries across our community as well, cleaning up the Jefferson Avenue business corridor. We'll also be honoring Ruth Whitfield. She was a caregiver. And when we talked to Garnell Whitfield, he talked about going and spending time with seniors in our community as well. So we'll be putting together flowers and care kits for the nursing staff at that facility as well. Filling a community fridge to volunteering, you know, at Go Bike's Ride to School Day. We have a variety of different ways. We're also thinking about the celebration of life because there's a community gathering that we'll be doing. So we're starting the day in service and ending it in community. We spoke to Celestine Cheney's son, and she said that she was an avid card player. So we're going to be having a card tournament in support and honor of her at the event as well.
I mean, it seems like a great way to kind of carry on the legacy of the victims, remembering things from their past and moving that forward. How much support do you have for this effort and this idea?
Yeah, so, you know, we had very early support from the majority leader of the council, Leah Halton Pope. She is putting together a resolution to actually call this a day of service on May 14th for every year. We've also had a variety of different foundations and organizations come together to say that, you know, they wanted to support. And we came up with the idea, but there was a lot of community support very early on.
You know, you mentioned a garden for Kat Massey, something for Ruth Whitfield. It seems like there might be something for each of these victims for people to get involved
in. Yeah. Absolutely. So we got in touch with many of the family members just to see how they wanted their family members honored through service. And so Mark Talley, he has an organization called Agents for Advocacy that he started in honor of his mother. So we're, you know, encouraging folks to donate there. We've also spoken to a variety of different family members. When we think about Aaron Salter, who was a police officer, he was building a hydro-powered car, right? And so we're going to have some STEM activities for kids. We'll have a whole kids zone during the community component of our event as well in honor of him. And so we've thought really intentionally trying to honor each individual family member and try to speak with every family member as well.
What's been the reaction so far to these ideas?
I mean, there's been a lot of support, very, very early support, and folks that are giving us, you know, a call to see how they can get involved and volunteer. So we're sending folks to ClementineGoldGroup.com, where we have a whole list of volunteering opportunities for that morning. And then we're also having a lot of, you know, opportunities for folks to get together in community as well. And so we want this to be a celebration of life. Obviously, you know, it doesn't erase the tragedy in terms of what happened, but we're hoping that this can put a positive spin on it and really honor those families and the victims who we lost as well.
You know, Akua, it's 3 years on Wednesday. How do you think the community is doing and healing?
Yeah, you know, it's a long process. I don't think that this is something that, you know, can turn around just in a matter of 3 years. We're still grieving as a community. Our offices are just a block away, and you can see that in the community. But I think you can also see, you know, the other side of that as well, right? The opportunities to get together and folks who are really banding together to make something happen in this community. So I think there's a duality in nature of what's happening, but we're hoping that this can, you know, be something that's positive for the community to get involved with over the long time.
Just 10 days after Gendron opened fire in Buffalo, 18-year-old Salvador Ramos fatally shot 19 children and two teachers at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. He also injured 17 others. Ramos was killed by law enforcement 77 minutes after he entered a classroom at the school. That time has been under scrutiny ever since, and local law enforcement has faced criticism for stalling outside and failing to save lives. The incident has also prompted discussion and efforts related to gun safety laws. KRLD 1080 in the Dallas-Fort Worth area reported on these efforts this February.
State Senator Roland Gutierrez rolled out six gun-related bills. Senate Bill 1656 would designate May 24th as Victims of the Uvalde Shooting Day. SB 1657 would raise the age to buy a semi-automatic rifle from 18 to 21.
77% of Republican men and women want to see an age limit increase. The people that don't want to have that happen are the Republicans in the Senate and the Republicans in the House.
Brett Cross lost his son Uzziah Garcia in the shooting at Robb Elementary.
I don't care how many times we get told no, we will continue to come back. Because no matter what we say or do, we can never bring our kids back, but we can help protect other kids.
Colt Gray is one of the youngest mass shooters in recent years. The then 14-year-old shot 11 people at Appalachie High School in Georgia last year. Two students and two teachers died, and seven more were injured. When someone so young commits a brutal crime with a firearm, people soon begin to question how they got a hold of a deadly weapon. Here's KRLD covering that question in 2024.
Developing story in Georgia with the school shooting there. Now the father's been arrested.
Just saw him in front of the judge.
They're having their first court appearance this morning. This is the 14-year-old charged in the shooting that killed four people, two students and two teachers at that high school in Winder, Georgia, and the 14-year-old's father. Arrested yesterday. They both had court hearings this morning. Colt Gray, the 14-year-old, advised of his rights, along with the charges and the penalties he faced. And shortly afterwards, his father, Colin Gray, was brought into court. He was charged yesterday in connection with the shooting for letting his son possess a weapon. It actually goes a little bit beyond that. Let's bring in News Nation national correspondent Elizabeth Pran. She's in Barrow County, Georgia, with the latest. Elizabeth, good morning.
Yeah, I mean, this story is, it's actually quite breathtaking. I mean, initially when we arrived on scene at the courthouse, you know, we were anticipating perhaps at the first appearance, not only would we only see the 14-year-old, but that it was going to be virtual. It's been really an onslaught of developments. In fact, I just walked away from a press conference with a district attorney because he said, look, at you know, these are initial charges. And especially when it comes to Colt, he has not been charged for the additional nine victims. As you know, eight students injured, one teacher. This is an additional to the four who have passed, who were shot to death on Wednesday. He also clarified some of the second-degree murder charges for the father because there were some questions around it. Why wouldn't it be four? Well, it pertains to some nuances in the Georgia law, and I don't want to bore your viewers, but it pertains to the heinous crimes when it comes to a child under the age of 18. So he clarified some of those. I asked him specifically if Colin, the father, the 54-year-old father, will be seeing additional charges. That's yet to be seen. But when Colt does receive those additional charges, we sort of start at ground zero, right? We have the charges filed. We have the arraignment, the first appearance, and that will take place. There is not a date set on that. There is a grand jury indictment date set for October 7th, and then preliminary hearing set for December 4th for both of these men. That, of course, is subject to change. But let me back up and start now at 9:30 when we saw the father, not anticipating to see the father. They did not have that in the plan. He walked into the courtroom, and it was very stoic because I want you to remember that there's optics here, right? There are victims' families who we saw arrive on scene as early as 7:30, dressed in black. They were flanked by security. They walked in. You could see them. They were hanging their heads low. It was actually horrendous to see. So they're in the front, and they watched both of the legal proceedings. So Colin walked in, and they had a conversation with the judge, very stoic, read him his rights, and then went through really a litany of charges, right? You have the two felony murder second-degree charges. You have the four felony involuntary manslaughter. You have the eight counts of cruelty to children in the second degree. That's up to 180 years behind bars. Now, if you go back about an hour, that's when we saw Colt. He walked in. The only thing he said was confirming his name. He didn't enter a plea. He was read his rights. Both of them are going to be getting new counsel throughout the afternoon, but they were represented when they arrived into court. And he did not set bond. So both of them are going to be behind bars. The 14-year-old is in a juvenile detention center just about 3 miles away. And then Colin is at the jail, which is on the campus where we are located. But again, the optics that we're seeing here is that, you know, as a consumer of news, we're trying to figure out who this person is, right, who allegedly carried out this crime. And then we're trying to be respectful that the community is still in such a state of shock. We were on the scene just about 2 hours after the first shots were fired. I mean, when I tell you mothers were running to the high school campus in flip-flops, a mile away, just trying to get to their children. So we're trying to honor both of these storylines, but the story is certainly still developing every minute that we're on the ground.
Ethan Crumbly was 15 years old, not very much older than Gray, when he opened fire on Oxford High School in Michigan 4 years ago, a few days before Thanksgiving, killing 4 people and injuring 7 others. He's been sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. And his parents, Jennifer and James Crumbly, were also charged with involuntary manslaughter and sentenced to 15 years in prison for giving him access to a firearm. Tim Carey with the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions told KNX News that both the Gray and Crumbly cases highlight the need for gun safety laws. Here's the interview from shortly after the Appalachian shooting last year.
So we've had countless shootings, mass shootings, school shootings, and 2 of these cases where the parents are charged. So going forward, if parents are charged, maybe other parents will do a better job of locking up their guns and preventing access for their kids. Or maybe kids who might be thinking about a mass shooting won't do it because they're concerned about their parents. But that's a lot of maybes. Do we just take progress where we can get it at this point?
Well, that's a tough question. I mean, it's very fact dependent, these sort of cases. I mean, we have research dating back from past few decades that show that the overwhelming majority of guns used in school shootings by youth are accessed in from their parents' homes, from the homes of friends, but what really distinguishes this case potentially, but especially the Crumbly case, is the egregious nature of it. That it shocks the senses, all of the meaningful opportunities for intervention that were missed and all of the harms that were actively enabled by the parents. And I think that really distinguishes what we're seeing here from perhaps shooting trends in the past.
Right, because we've got this reporting that this gun was a gift after the law enforcement actually came to interview the whole family about these online posts. There was a post on Discord talking about a shooting, and of course the kid said, I wouldn't have ever made those, that wasn't me. But if the cops search your house and they want to talk to you about all that and you still buy a rifle for your son, then, I mean, that's where the prosecutors are starting to draw all these links.
No, exactly. And that's, again, what we saw in the Crumbly case, where the parents actively gave the child the gun, ignored clear concerns from school staff that they'd seen disturbing messages and threats and about violence that then later culminated into a shooting later that day. And again, facts are still emerging in this Georgia case, but we are starting to see some parallels here.
Increasing accountability for these shootings, of course, is one step, but you've said much more needs to be done in terms of mitigating the risks of more gun violence in schools. What does that mean?
Exactly. The best cure is prevention. And there are a broad array of evidence-informed toolkits that can help prevent shootings like this from happening, especially in this case. There are 2 laws that come to mind particularly. The first are safe storage laws, especially child access prevention laws that many states across the country already have, that essentially require adults, firearm owners, to store their guns in safe and secure manner, especially when they think that they could potentially be accessed by children and people who shouldn't have access. We've seen these laws have a profound impact, especially on reducing pediatric firearm injuries, reducing firearm suicides, especially for adolescents, as well as some promising data for shootings and homicides and gun deaths as a whole. But in this case, if it's true that the father gave the child the gun instead of the child accessing it through some impermissible means, there's also another law that could have potentially been helpful, which are known as extreme risk protection orders, otherwise called red flag laws, that 21 states and the District of Columbia have, that allow courts to temporarily disarm people if those individuals are found to pose a serious risk of harm to themselves or others with firearms. And this case seems like a textbook instance of where that law could have saved lives.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
In Buffalo, acts of service have been helping the community mourn the victims of the Tops shooting. However, grief is complicated, and there are no easy answers for moving on when lives are violently taken. Nicole Beausoleil is the mother of Madison Baldwin, one of Crumbly's victims. Beausoleil shared her experience in the wake of losing her 17-year-old daughter in this audio provided by WWJ News Radio.
I would like to start with the person that matters the most. Madison, she was a kind soul. She always had a smile on her face. She lit up the room when she walked in. Her laugh I could listen to all day. It was infectious. Her big sister skills were undeniable, and she took that role very seriously. Madison was smart, funny, loving, passionate, determined, and genuine. Her expectations were high, and at times we needed to let her fall. She needed to be reminded that not everything is perfect, even if she wanted it to be. Madison had an influence that most never achieved. Sometimes I would listen to a poem she wrote or watched her create art with no tracing, just pure talent. She would talk about college and what major she would like to do and what would be most helpful to society. The passion that she had for everything and everyone was remarkable. I would catch myself watching her and thinking to myself, how lucky am I? I'm the one that gets to be her mom. What did I do to deserve a perfect person? She will be the best thing to ever happen to me at such a young age myself. I grew up because of her. We grew together. I learned from her. I mattered because of her. From the moment she was born, I promised myself that I would be there no matter what. Through the falls, heartbreak, letdowns, and struggles, I would be there. I would listen, learn, and love every moment. I wouldn't miss a thing. I would always protect her. On November 30th, 2021, exactly 17 years, 6 months, and 13 days, made me break my first promise, and it will hurt for eternity. As her mom, I didn't protect her. First, I'd like to say thank you to the prosecution team. I say thank you to you all. Saying thank you really doesn't seem enough anymore. The countless hours you've worked, time away from your family, and always taking our feelings into consideration.
She also had words for Crumbly's parents.
My mind keeps going back to something during the trials. Something that is almost on repeat, like a broken record. It's something as a mother I can't understand. And honestly, I don't think any mother would understand. It was when Jennifer said, I wouldn't do anything different. I'm putting a little emphasis on different, as I know life throws us things that are out of our control. But life takes turns and eventually puts them back in our control. Like giving you a hint when something needs to change. I want to compare a few things to see through my perspective. As I know things are different, about the events and how we see them from the events on November 30th. While your son was hearing voices and asking for help, I was helping Madison pick out her senior classes. While you were purchasing a gun for your son and leaving it unlocked, I was helping her finish her college essays. While you dropped him off at school, upset that he was failing class, I texted Madison, "Drive safe, it's slick outside, have a good day." When you got a call to meet at the school about your son and how it interfered with your day, I was rearranging my schedule so I could take Madison to get her oil changed for the first time. When you left without hesitation and not taking him home, I was worried if she'd be okay driving in the first snowfall of the season and if she brought a coat. When you walked out of the office with a steady pace after hearing an active shooter, I ran from my home and started driving, trying not to break the law. When you were on the phone for 10 minutes with each other trying to figure out where the gun was, I was on the phone with her father and family trying to figure out where she was. When you left the Myers without knowing where your son was, I was desperately trying to get there as soon as possible. When you knew the gun was missing, you called the police, knowing it was your son who took it. I was having family call every hospital describing what she looked like. When you texted, "Ethan, don't do it," I was texting Madison, "I love you, please call mom." When you found out about the lives your son took that day, I was still waiting for my daughter in a parking lot. When you questioned the reasoning on why you would do this, I was questioning if I was doing enough to find her. When you got a chance to speak with your son, seeing him alive and showing no support, I was watching families reunite with their children, waiting for my moment. When you asked him why, I was waiting for the answer on to why the last bus never came. When you and the police showed up at your house, you didn't understand why they were there. And I was asking police if they checked every possible location and if I could go search too. When you texted about not losing your job and you needed a lawyer, I was still calling my daughter because she came first in all parts of my life. When you could leave your house, I was still a prisoner in Myers. When you worried about what people thought of you and feeling threatened, I was learning your son threatened my daughter and fatally shot her in the head. When you drove to get your burner phones for communication, I was laying on the floor in Myers for hours crying because I forgot how to speak. When you checked into your first hotel, I was telling Madison's 11-year-old sister she was gone. When you cared more about yourself and getting alcohol and supplies, I was identifying my daughter at a medical office, wishing I could take her place. While you were hiding, I was planning her funeral. And while you were running away from your son and your responsibilities, I was forced to do the worst possible thing a parent could do. I was forced to say goodbye to my Madison. We all see things different. Some prioritize and some don't. Accountability can only be given if you actually try it in the first place.
Thank you for listening to this True Crime Roundup from the On Deadline podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks to WBEN Radio in Buffalo KRLD 1080 in Dallas-Fort Worth, KNX Radio in Los Angeles, and WWJ News Radio in Detroit. You can find these roundups by subscribing to the On Deadline podcast, the Who Killed Strawberry podcast, and the Bitter Academia podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Kendra Adachi, and my show, The Lazy Genius Podcast, helps you be a genius about the things that matter and lazy about the things that don't, and you get to decide what matters. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here to give you a new way to see. Episodes of The Lazy Genius Podcast are full of compassionate time management tips and permission slips to do what makes sense for you. New episodes drop every Monday. Follow and listen to The Lazy Genius Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.